Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I love listening to dialogue written by David Mamet. It has the same effect on me as good music. I want to replay it over and over again. Mamet is one of America's most important playwrights and screenwriters. His plays include the Pulitzer Prize-winning Glengarry Glen Ross, Speed the Plow, American Buffalo, and Sexual Perversity in Chicago. He wrote and directed the films House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide, and wrote the screenplays for The Untouchables, The Verdict, and Hoffa. His film version of his play Oleana opens next month. Also about to open is a film of his adaptation of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. Now David Mamet has written his first novel. It's called The Village, and it's set in Vermont, where he lives part of each year. I asked Mamet if the dialogue he writes for actors is different from the dialogue on the page in his new novel.
I think that what I'm concerned about is rhythm. And on a stage, the actors communicate with each other, and the play is communicated to the audience through the rhythm of their speech. But on a page, I find it fascinating that the rhythm is very, very different. If you transpose the actual dialogue onto the page, the nature of the medium is such that the rhythm is going to be changed by the interpolation of descriptions. He said, she said, and then he picked up the coffee cup, and so that the most important rhythm, it seems to me, on the page is the rhythm of the written line, which contains both the dialogue and description, rather than the rhythm of the dialogue itself, which on the stage is all that you have.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned rhythm, because I haven't have a scene picked out from your film Homicide, which you wrote and directed, which I think it really just shows the kind of rhythm that you get between two characters that you write for. And this is a scene from fairly early on in Homicide. The story is about two cops, partners, played by Joe Mantegna and Bill Macy. And Mantegna is a cop who's been unjustly reprimanded by his new boss after the FBI has bungled a case. And his new boss has called Mantegna a kike. Macy has just stood up for him. And here's Mantegna and Macy in the cop car together talking.
Man's got no call to question my loyalty.
How's your head?
He had no call to get racial on me.
So he called you one, you called him one. We get to the gym.
Son of a bitch is gonna go.
Yeah, I feel it too.
Piece of cake.
Either a piece of cake or a slice of life. You notice that?
Yeah, I remarked that. Ain't that the truth?
That is the truth.
We could have brought the son of a bitch in with a knock on the door.
Well, let's go bring him in then.
That's right.
Garner some of them kudos and all that they got.
That's right. FBI, man.
That's right.
FBI could f*** a baked potato.
FBI couldn't find Joe Lewis in a bowl of rice. You know what's needed here?
What, Sully?
Police work.
Yeah. Some of that police work that people talk about. What happened to the job? F*** politics, man. Nothing but politics. Mother f*** called me a kike.
I heard him.
Job's changed. It ain't the same job.
The job's the same.
Yeah.
People dying, people killing them.
I think of you writing lines in a very musical way and then being performed, when performed well, in a musical way. And when I read your screenplays, I can see that, you know, you italicize certain words for emphasis. Some words you put in parentheses so that they'll be read in a different way. If you want to pause, you'll write beat after the phrase is over. Do you think of yourself as scoring the dialogue?
I suppose it's one way one could look at it. I just think of it as writing it. And, you know, you were describing the various things that I do and writing dialogue, and I thought, oh, what a terrible way for a writer to behave. And then I comforted myself by saying, well, at least I don't write stage directions.
Well, do the actors, are the actors bothered by the fact that you're telling them where the emphasis should fall and where the beat should fall?
I don't think so. I think that, well, first off, I tend to work with the same actors all the time. I mean,
like Mantegna and Macy, who we just heard.
That's right. I mean, we go back about a quarter of a century together, the three of us. One of the nice things about working with the same people over and over again is that it's great to be trusted. It's great to be able to give an actor a script and know that he or she will trust that the line's going to work, and read the line as it's written.
Were the people in your family good talkers?
Oh, no, they were great talkers. Good wasn't even in it. They were, and the surviving members continued to be the best talkers that ever lived.
What made them great?
Well, many things. Our Ashkenazi Jewish heritage, the fact that my parents both grew up in the Depression and in poverty, perhaps a disrupted family life, and a 6,000-year-old Jewish tradition of love of argument.
You started off as an actor, right?
Yeah, that's right. I was actually a child actor in Chicago. When I was just a kid, but I guess that's when one would be a child actor. And then I got interested in community theater. Mm-hmm. And then I went, was very interested in acting in college. And as I say, I studied for a while in New York, and I tried to support myself as an actor and did marginally for a while, and realized that I was either going to need a personality transplant or I was going to starve. And loath to leave the theater, I did what countless millions have done before me. I found something else I could do inside of that society, and that happened to be directing.
Why did you mention a personality transplant?
I didn't have the personality to be an actor. I mean, I think it's a great gift. I think acting is a skill which many people can learn a little bit of, and which a few people can learn a lot of, and which several people are born with a great talent for. And I think I didn't belong to any of those groups.
So you didn't think you were very good at it?
No, I knew I wasn't any good at it.
Did you have the ego for it?
The ego? No, I think I had too much ego. I think that was the problem.
Uh-huh.
I think that...
How does that get in the way? Too much ego?
You know, Sandy Meisner was my teacher at the Playhouse. I seem to be talking about that a lot. I think it's because I'm in the studio, which happens to be about four blocks from where the school was. I seldom come back to this neighborhood. He used to say it took about 20 years to make an actor. And I often wondered what he meant. But now I've had the experience of working with actors, with the same actors, for 20, some of them for 20 years and more, and have seen the great sacrifices, the great dedication, and the, to use a perhaps overblown word, the cleansing process that one has to go through to become a great actor, to have the ego pared away and the preconceptions pared away, and to have one's courage and character built up by years of striving. And it's a magnificent process. And it's been a great privilege to watch it, and the actors that I've worked with for those years.
Was your ego so big that you would be rewriting the lines that you were given?
Exactly so. I mean, perhaps I'm being too harsh on myself. Perhaps it wasn't a question of ego. Perhaps it was just a question of disposition. But that was my disposition, to want to rewrite the lines, to want to correct the director, etc.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Mamet, and he has a new novel, his first novel, called The Village. You've written that most acting training is based on shame and guilt. How did you experience that?
Well, I went to a lot of acting classes and worked with a lot of directors, and I didn't see many of them that were capable of stating a direction or an instruction that was capable of being fulfilled. One heard a lot in the back in the 60s and 70s, and perhaps one still does today, things like feel it more, be more yourself, relax, feel the space, use the space, listen to it with your body, reach out to the other person, talk like you mean it. These are words which don't mean anything and which mask, on the part of the speaker, either an ignorance of their subject matter or the desire to defraud. And they confuse the hell out of me as an actor.
So I imagine these are directions you try to never give actors who are working with you.
That's right.
What might you tell them instead?
Well, what I try to do as a director is understand what the scene's about and communicate it to the actor in specific ways. Somebody wrote, if the direction is more generalized or less actable and go over there and open the window, it's no good. And so that is the kind of direction to which I aspire. And it calls for a lot of thought sometime on the part of the director, because there are many times under pressure, and directors, as the actor is under pressure quite a lot, there's a tendency to think, oh my God, just do it better. But that sure don't help the actor. And B, the actor's trying to do it better. That's all the actor wants to do, is do it better, for God's sake.
From reading your essays, I get the impression that you don't like it when somebody tries to put a lot of emotion into a scene, you know, and to put a lot of their personal expression into a scene. You write, the more an actor tries to make each physical action carry the meaning of the scene, the more the actor is ruining your movie.
Well, they're also ruining their performance, sure.
By putting in too much.
Sure. I mean, all of us have had the experience, and we have it more the older we get, of being in extraordinarily dramatic life situations, birth, death, loss, betrayal, enlightenment, danger, humiliation. And I think I've reflected, and I think that others perhaps have a similar experience, that in these situations, we and those around us tend to act in a rather undramatic manner, because our task and our difficulty are so vast that we have no energy left over to describe them to ourselves or to communicate them to others. We have only energy left over to do them as simply as possible, because our life depends on it. And that, to me, is what great acting is. It's doing the most extraordinary things in the simplest possible manner.
You grew up in a middle-class family in Chicago, but you write that you used to think that the middle class was unfit for literature. Why did you think that, and what, if anything, changed you?
Well, I wanted to get out of the house. I was a nice Jewish boy. I think I probably am a nice Jewish boy, and that... And I wanted to be anything but a nice Jewish boy. I wanted to be Jack Kerouac, you know, or Jack London, or someone named Jack. And so the one thing I didn't want to do was to write about that day-to-day bourgeois existence. Now, I turn around 30 years later and I see much of the stuff that I wrote under the guise of the picaresque was nothing other than a domestic play. You know, whether it's American Buffalo is finally a play about a family constellation.
Well, did not wanting to write about your own middle-class life have anything to do with writing about con men and cops? And
sure, I mean, that was another part of the escape. Yeah, I wanted to get out of the birth family, and perhaps like a lot of people who go into a hermetic world, I wanted to escape into another family.
Well, how did you, I mean, it seems to me you ended up hanging out at pool halls and having your poker games and, you know, meeting people from a different world. How did you meet them?
I got out of the house, and I was I had to make a living. I was out there working at many different kinds of jobs, and meeting very interesting people. And I loved it.
What kinds of jobs?
Well, I worked in a truck factory. I drove a cab. Worked for a while one summer on the ore boats. Worked in a canning factory. I sold land over the telephone. I cleaned offices. Worked in a book. I did a bookshop. I did a lot of food work, busing and short order cooking, and waited on tables.
You have one of your early plays is called A Life in the Theater. And you've written that you were taught and that you believe that the purpose of the play is to bring to the stage the life of the human soul. Now, the actors in your play, A Life in the Theater, say they believe that too, but all the plays they act in are like the worst cliches, the lifeboat scene,
right,
the battle scene when a young soldier's tour of duty is up in 2 hours, but he's about to be shot down in battle.
Right.
I wonder, in your life in the theater when you were an actor, if you were up against that too, having all these like deeply felt aesthetic ideas of what a life in the theater is, but you found yourself acting things that you in fact thought were quite cliched.
Oh, sure. Sure. That quote, by the way, is from Stanislavski. I do believe it, that that's the task of the theater, is to bring to the stage the life of the human soul. But that's a quote from Konstantin Stanislavski.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. You know, one is, I was once at Sardi's restaurant here, and they just refurbished it, and I looked out, and I was given a speech for something or other. I can't remember what it was. And I looked out, and I said, "So nice to be back here at Sardi's and look out at all these beautiful tables. And I know that there has never been a conversation at any of these tables which did not contain the phrase, "And do you know what that son of a bitch did?" So you talk about having difficulty dealing with cliches in the theater at one point. Well, all of us in the theater on day one and on day 20 and 30 years later and 50 years later and 80 years later still get together every night. One could say, A, with a sense of wonder at the world around us, or one could say equally B, bitching at the very interesting and the very exacting life we've chosen.
David Mamet, I wish we had more time. It's been a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure talking to you, finally.
David Mamet's new novel is called The Village. His film adaptation of his play Oleana opens next month. This is Fresh Air.